Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, April 26th. Wow, it's almost the end of April. I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria, and this week we have a great one for you. But before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who help make Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that is because I rely on the support both of my advertisers and of people just like you. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways to do it, and you can learn all about them by visiting my website, carasantamaria.com or talknerdy.com. There you can click through to the Talk Nerdy store, which you can also access at talknerdymerch.com. You can rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, you can pledge your support at Patreon by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy. This week's top patrons include Mary Neva, Michael Gaucher, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Elise Christie, and Robert Christ. You can pledge as little as a dollar per episode, and that money really does go a long way to help pay for all of the things that are required to go into the show, including the editor, my assistant who does all of the social media and actually does a lot kind of in the back end, like uploading files and taking care of scheduling guests and things like that. And of course, all those people got to get paid. So yeah, thank you all so much for supporting the show. I think now in like our seventh year? What? That's bananas. It really does mean a lot to me. All right, so let's talk about this week's episode. This is a fascinating one. I had the opportunity to sit down with Annalee Newitz to talk about their newest book. Now, if you don't know Annalee, follow them on Twitter right now. Annalee's a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. Also, they founded IO9. You remember IO9? And they were the former editor-in-chief of Gizmodo. And they now co-host a Hugo Award-winning podcast called Our Opinions Are Correct. This is Annalee's, I think, second sort of nonfiction book, but they also write, I love this, science fiction. I had no idea. But this book is called Four Lost Cities, A Secret History of the Urban Age. So without any further ado, here they are, Annalee Newitz. Well, Annalee, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
I'm excited that we finally were able to get together after multiple failed attempts.
Yep, the joys of technology.
Oh, yes, technology in the time of a pandemic. I'm super pumped to talk to you about your new book. Oftentimes when I have authors on the show, I end up talking to them a lot about their lives and their journeys and their paths, and then we touch a little bit on the book. And in some ways, you're kind of the opposite, because I don't really, I mean, you are an author, you've written books, and you're badass, but I don't think of you as an author, because I think of you as a science writer, editor, who's like putting out a lot of content. So I guess that's an author too.
Yeah, it's like writing, it's content, you know, I have the psychic link directly to the internet. So I'm just like feeding
me
my thoughts.
Yeah, so I think if you're that person, who's just feeding me my thoughts. But because of that, you know, there's so much about kind of your life and your work, but I'm freaking fascinated by this book. And I feel like we would also be really remiss if we didn't maybe just touch on the four lost cities. That is the title of the book, Four Lost Cities. If we didn't touch a little bit on each of those four cities, because I don't know, there's so much here. Okay, so let's take a breath. Talk about what brought you to write about this specific topic, and then there's so much more I want to dig into.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of things that came together, but I think the most obvious is that I love cities, and I grew up in the suburbs and kind of violently rejected them and moved to the city as soon as I could move out of my parents' house. And I think, you know, for a lot of writers, we always want to like destroy the things we love by studying them. And, you know, and it's kind of a way of destroying it, but it's also kind of a way of becoming more intimate with the topic. And so definitely a big part of it was just wanting to believe that cities will last forever, and also at the same time wanting to be realistic and understand why they don't last forever, and why this beloved thing may go away.
Right. Oh, I love that. Because I think that, I mean, I'm not saying anything new here, but living in modern society, especially those of us who are, you know, parentheses, unclosed parentheses, lucky enough to live here in the United States, because in so many ways we are lucky, and to kind of be surrounded by the type of wealth and the type of power that sort of is part of a mega culture and a superpower, is that we forget that these things have happened before and that they ebb and flow, that there's not a permanence. Everything feels so permanent because we think of it as being like infrastructure.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, we know that infrastructure also dies, and that's part of one of the debates that we're having right now as a country in the United States, is whether we should rescue our infrastructure, and also what even is infrastructure anymore, because that's another part of the joy of cities and also the frustration, is that cities change all the time. And so what we think of as infrastructure also changes, because infrastructure is a function of technological advances, scientific advances. When we look back at ancient cities, oftentimes archaeologists will say like, oh, well, there was this great innovation in, you know, building bridges. And suddenly you see all these soaring bridges in cities. And, you know, those have to be maintained. And, you know, the story of a lot of ancient cities is they just didn't maintain these new high-tech bridges and high-tech buildings. And we're seeing, you know, that reflected today in our cities where, you know, internet infrastructure and energy infrastructure aren't being maintained. And there's all these questions about whether those even are infrastructure, which seems bizarre to me. But that really is, I think, a recurring theme in cities, is people just saying like, well, I don't think that's infrastructure. We don't need to maintain that.
Yeah. And also this, and you talk about this so well, and it's something that I've always loved about your writing, and about not just your writing, but your like curation and your editing, which is this this inclusion and this real open eye towards social justice and diversity, and ensuring that the stories of the people who don't often get to tell their stories are amplified and elevated. And when we talk about infrastructure and infrastructure failure, one of the things that comes to my mind is, you know, how incredibly not egalitarian that failure is. We tend to maintain infrastructure in places where people who have money and power are annoyed by its failures. And in places where people who don't have money and power are not just annoyed, but literally threatened by its failures, we tend to allow it to continue to crumble.
Yeah, or they're displaced by the failures. And I think one of the sort of subplots of Four Lost Cities is that cities don't actually get lost. When you talk about a city being lost, it makes it sound like somebody's like, oops, the city fell out of my pocket. Where could it be? Did I leave it somewhere in this jungle? And in reality, what it is a rejection, that people abandon that city. They take the initiative to leave, whether with a heavy heart or maybe with a just kind of fuck you attitude, like the city sucks. And that's almost always because the city is suffering from infrastructure failures and political failures. It's always the double whammy. You know, you don't get a city failing when it has resilient government that responds to what people need, and including people in neighborhoods of immigrants and neighborhoods of working class type people. Those, in many ways, are the most important neighborhoods in a city. And when you start neglecting them, it means that basic city services are no longer done, because these are, you know, neighborhoods of the people who actually build the cities and build the roads and drive the buses and own the stores that sell you, you know, tasty fizzy drinks. Or if you're in ancient Rome, they sell you fish oil, you know, just depending on what your luxury commodity is. So yeah, it was really important to me to have this book be shaped by the agency and the life stories of people who actually are building the cities and who are coming to the cities to seek their fortunes. And sometimes they find those fortunes, and sometimes they find a city that's in the process of neglecting all the things that make it a great city, you know, neglecting the beautiful roads or neglecting water infrastructure that brings, you know, fresh water to the crops.
You know, something that you touched on there is this idea of the kind of heterogeneity of cities, how there's something fundamentally different about the city versus a more rural or country part of a culture or a society, in that the city is where it's happening. The city is where the efforts are being put into things like infrastructure. And the city is a place where people come together from sometimes different walks of life, you know, depending, I think, on how ancient a city we're talking about. The heterogeneity may be in race, it may be in, obviously, it's always going to be in gender, but it may be in class, and it may be in other kind of other intersectional aspects. But the thing that kind of strikes me about your writing is this idea that, you're right, the people who with their own hands are affecting change within the city are often the ones who are left out of the conversation.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, you know, cities are people. You know, there's going to always be someone running through the streets in my mind yelling, "The city is made of people." And, you know, it's absolutely one of the great contradictions of urban life, that the people who are most vital to the city are also the people regarded as most expendable by the elites in that city. And by the same token, we see a pattern again and again where cities start to teeter on the brink of falling apart, and the elites just go fuck off first. Like, the elites are like, okay, we're leaving. We're relocating our, you know, the center of our kingdom to somewhere else, or we're moving to other cities, and we'll just leave behind all these people who actually built the city in the first place. And what's interesting, in the process of researching this book, one thing that I found is that in several cities, once the elites leave, there's a kind of revitalization that takes place, where the people who remain, who are often, you know, artisans and working class people or formerly enslaved people, they take the reins and they start rebuilding. At Angkor, which was the capital of the Khmer Empire, and kind of at its biggest about 1,000 years ago, we see that once the elites leave in the 15th century, people start doing things like recycling stones from the elite temples and palaces and using them to repair bridges. And it's just this beautiful kind of encapsulation of what can happen in a city to turn its fate around. Like, it doesn't have to be that, like, you get a giant, like, you don't need a new regime. You don't need a new king to come in. You can actually hand the reins over to the people, and they will try to repair that infrastructure and often succeed.
You know, I love how relevant even these cities that are thousands of years old are to our modern experience. When we really think about things like geopolitical conflict, when we think about things like government overreach, we think about class warfare, and some of the things that, you know, are striking citizens around the world, even to this day, these are recapitulations of things we've seen in the past and we can learn from in the past. But even as you mentioned, for example, Angkor, the little kind of alarms went off in my head, like, and where is that now? What, who, how? And so I wanted to make sure that we discuss a little bit where the four cities that you chose to write about are, like in modern geography, and who the people were that lived there.
Sure. So to start with Angkor, since we were just discussing it, today it's located in Cambodia. And, you know, about 1,000 years ago, Cambodia, of course, didn't exist. And there was the Khmer Empire, which really encompassed huge parts of Southeast Asia. So what we think of today as Thailand and Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, all of those places and some others, too, were at various points part of the Khmer Empire. And it lasted for several hundred years. It had deep roots in the region. You know, the sort of Khmer culture grew out of a long history of migrations and trading of ideas with South Asia. So it's a very interesting, rich history there. And then the other three cities, one of which will be very familiar to people, is Pompeii. Everyone's pretty familiar with why Pompeii was destroyed, especially if you watch the documentary film Pompeii with Kit Harington, which is super accurate. it all happened just like that. So Pompeii is kind of an exception, actually, in this book, because the ending is so obvious, like why it ended and sort of what led to its demise. But what's not obvious is that you know, around 2,000 years ago, when Vesuvius erupts, only about 10% of the city is killed in that disaster, and the rest of them become refugees. And the Roman Empire has to come up with a refugee package, a rescue package for these people to help them resettle. And it's a really fascinating look at how disaster relief packages worked back in the day, and they did indeed work, and people were resettled and found new lives.
Oh, it's so interesting. You're right, like, to interject this idea in our minds, the caricature of Pompeii is that everybody was just covered in ash and lava. Like, literally everybody in the town just got trapped.
Yeah, that everybody was just sort of walking down the street and all of a sudden, like, whoa, you know, blast of hot air. And the fact is that actually, you know, this kind of eruption is preceded by earthquakes, which had been happening. And so people were, when archaeologists look at the remains of Pompeii that have been excavated, they see a city in the process of evacuation. Like, nothing is where it's supposed to be. People are leaving. People have packed all their stuff. You see like carts that are like pulled up in front of houses. You know, it's very clear that, you know, people had been running away. And indeed, 90% of them made it out, and which is really extraordinary. So the other two cities are Çatalhöyük, which is a 9,000-year-old city in central Turkey. It's located near a large cosmopolitan city called Konya today. And you can get there basically by flying into the Konya airport and driving out to see Çatalhöyük. And the other city is on the other end of the planet is Cahokia, which was an indigenous city, which is located in southern Illinois. It was at its kind of most populated about 1,000 years ago. And it is a what's called a mound city, which means its biggest monuments were these huge earthen mounds, like packed earth pyramids. The biggest remaining pyramid, which is nicknamed Monk's Mound, has a footprint about the size of the Great Pyramid at Giza, just to give you a sense of how enormous it is. And these are flat-topped, packed earth pyramids. So on the flat top, there would have been ceremonial structures. People may have lived up there. Elites possibly lived up there. And certainly there was a place where sort of halfway up that pyramid, there was almost like a stage where people could address the city. And below, there's a huge plaza. So we know that there was a lot of like public activity and political activity taking place around this massive pyramid. But the city itself is full of other mounds, different shapes and different sizes that were both architectural features and probably decorative or spiritual features. They served a lot of different purposes. But when white settlers encountered the city 200 or 300 years ago, it was very obvious that it had been this incredible place. It had been long abandoned by the framers of the city. And the Cahokia tribe was living there at the time. So Europeans were like, let's call it Cahokia. So, which is better than calling it like the name of the guy who right. found, you know, like they, at least they didn't name it like Bob Smith
or just
Town
like or New Birmingham. You know, like, yeah. Exactly. We are so uncreative.
Yeah, exactly. So they, so it was the whole, you know, area. Is right next to the Mississippi River, basically right near East St. Louis. And so it was just this field of mounds, like stretching all the way from, you know, southern Illinois all the way up to the Mississippi. And then in St. Louis, there were also enormous mounds. So this was a city that was a huge, sprawling place. And, you know, Europeans actively suppressed information about it, you know, just didn't want to believe that it had been made by indigenous people. My favorite story about that is that it was proposed that perhaps ancient Egyptians had come over and built it, because that makes sense, you know. And now, of course, people would say it was ancient aliens.
Well, I was going to say that, like, I have a friend who works on that show and she's very embarrassed about that fact, but she's like, you know, and she's like a youngish Black woman. And, you know, anytime we talk about kind of the work, she's like, this show is so racist. I can't even like mm-hmm. just this idea that it's beyond reason that, you know, an indigenous population could have technology. So it must have been that aliens came down and bestowed that upon them, because it's just, can you imagine that brown people would have had technology a long time ago? And it's like,
oh yeah, or sophisticated urban civilizations with thousands of years of history. Yeah, I always say to people like, yep, Occam's razor, it was probably ancient aliens from Egypt. Like look, let's start with the most plausible explanation and then just like move on.
Well, and you see that recapitulated, you know, I was raised in the Mormon faith, and you see that recapitulated in their mythology, this idea that the lost tribes of Israel came over to the U.S. to then become these indigenous tribes, the Nephites and the Lamanites. Like you see this racism recapitulated over and over, because it's somehow unfathomable to white settlers that the individuals who previously and for a very long time lived on, occupied, and called this land home could possibly have any sort of sophisticated anything. I mean, it's just, it blows my mind the level of racism.
I think it's, you know, it's part of this longstanding myth, again, among white settlers about what the United States really was and how to justify westward expansion and how, you know, how do you, you know, tell yourself that it's okay to take over land. And the way you do it is by saying, well, nobody's here. It's a virgin land. And, oh, we found some mounds, but they probably are just some kind of weird anomaly. Like, and it's funny because Cahokia, the mound city, was really just kind of, it was a lot like Angkor. It was at the center of a really big culture. And all along the Mississippi River in the south, you find smaller mound cities that are, you know, cities that have clear remaining mounds. And you see lots of cities in the south that are named Mound or Mounds or Moundville. People knew about it, you know, and they just... you know, it's amazing how ideology can be such a hell of a drug. You know, you can just, you can see something with your own eyes. You can name your frickin' city Moundville and still deny that there's this incredible long history of people having great civilizations here. And these mound builders weren't even the first. You know, there were mound building civilizations 5,000 years ago in the Americas. And it seems pretty clear that the people who built Cahokia starting in like the 900s had definitely looked back and had seen these previous civilizations in the same way that like when people came to the Americas from Europe and they were like, let's build a capital at Washington, D.C. We'll make it look Roman, you know, and they're like, let's imitate this ancient style of our ancestors. And that's what the people at Cahokia were doing. They're like, oh, our badass ancient ancestors built these mounds. So let's us do it, too. And that'll just make us even more cool. And indeed, it did. It made them really cool. And they had this fantastic city that looked great. So
it just blows my mind how, as I'm sitting here talking to you, as I'm looking at your writing, and I'm thinking to myself, like, good God, am I ignorant that I didn't even know about an American, you know, an indigenous American thriving metropolis. I didn't learn about this in school. I didn't, you know, I remember thinking back to, I had it bad because I grew up in Texas, right? So I had that Texas textbook bias, which is rough. And I had to unlearn a lot and relearn a lot as I became an adult. But, you know, it's like the image or the mythology that we're taught is that Native Americans were all hunter-gatherers. That we did learn about things like, I remember learning like teepee versus longhouse, you know, like different societies and cultures built their homes differently, but never two and two together that a home is a somewhat permanent structure. And that if you're putting down roots, that you're also going to put down societal, you know, and whether it's just kinship or larger kind of structures, governmental structures, that there's going to be some amount of organization required, and that, yes, cities would have existed. But the concept of a city in ancient America is something that literally was not even a thought in my mind.
Yeah, and I think, again, this is just a great example of how bias, either unconscious or in many cases conscious bias, just kind of purges our history of this stuff. And that's part of why I have the title Four Lost Cities, because I was kind of snarking at the idea of lost cities. Because, as I said earlier, you don't lose a city. You can try to deliberately erase a city from history. And that's what happened with Cahokia. Or you can, you know, encounter a city as a European that comes from a tradition that's so far removed from yours that it seems like you're discovering something lost. But to the local people, for example, this is exactly what happened with Angkor. When Europeans went to Angkor in the 19th century, they, of course, discovered a bunch of monks living in Angkor Wat, which is one of the temple enclosures there. And there's tons of farmers all around. Like, people knew that these incredible architectural marvels were still there in the jungle. And still, Europeans said, we discovered this.
Right.
It was lost all this time. And it was like, no, dude, it wasn't lost. You were just ignorant of how there were these incredible metropolitan histories in other parts of the world that weren't Europe.
It's like that Eddie Izzard stand-up when he talks about colonialism. Like, I claim this for Mother England. And it's like, but we live here, yo. Exactly. He's like, do you have a flag?
I claim this for Mars.
Yeah, it's like, no, bro. Like, we've been here this whole time. But you don't have a flag. Yeah. It's like, our rules.
You don't have a flag and... I don't acknowledge your history, and your language doesn't look right to me. So I don't even believe that you have writing, because, you know, it doesn't look like what I think writing should look like.
How sad this bigger conversation about how much, and it's true, it's kind of like you use the word lost as sort of a middle finger. You say a secret history of the urban age, because it's intentionally made secret by those who, you know, whether they chose to do it because of overt or because of implicit bias, basically said, I don't recognize your customs, your ways as being customs and ways. And so because of that, I won't document them.
That's absolutely right. And one of the things that I really dive into a lot in this book is the fact that there are multiple urban traditions across the earth. It seems as if City building is an example of convergent evolution. Like it independently arises in very disconnected cultures, disconnected continents.
Yeah. Like what happens when people get together? They have to figure out how to be together.
Yeah. And especially once you start getting together in larger and larger groups. And so it's what happens, though, is that you see an urban tradition arising in the Americas, which is very different from Southeast Asia, which is very different from in Europe. And the fascinating thing for us in the present moment is to consider that here in the West, is to consider that maybe some of these other urban traditions, especially ones that are tropical urban traditions, where, for example, a city like Angkor, which had about 1 million people in it. I mean, it was not, you know, a tiny place. They were dealing with climate conditions that were incredibly difficult and that involved a lot of changes over time. Like they would have radical droughts, then they would have flooding. And even in a year that wasn't a bad drought or flood year, they're still dealing with two monsoon systems that hit right around where Angkor is located in Cambodia. And so every year they have incredibly dry, dry seasons, incredibly wet, wet seasons. And yet they still maintain this incredible metropolitan lifestyle. I mean, I hate to use the word lifestyle, but that's what it is. You know, people came to Angkor because it was a place where you could become an artist and work full time as an artist and have like a pretty nice life, you know, something that I think people in, you know, modern day San Francisco would recognize as kind of a hipster lifestyle. And they were dealing with these really adverse climate conditions that are going to become commonplace for a lot of cities now in the global north, too, as we're coping with flooding more often because climate change, of course, makes these extreme weather conditions more likely to happen. And we're also going to be dealing with droughts more often here in California. Finally, our governor has once again acknowledged that we're in drought. And so by looking at how cities in other kinds of traditions have dealt with these things, we can start to think about redesigning our own cities. And, you know, maybe the European tradition of city building isn't a good fit for California. Or it isn't a good fit for Texas, which is actually dealing with a lot of the same shit that we're dealing with in California right now.
In some ways, the stuff that we dealt with, like with our failing power grid, just, you know, a decade or two in advance of Texas, we kind of had the same problem having our own grid that was disconnected from the rest of the country, having not done the upkeep that we needed to do. And ours failed. Texas clearly didn't learn from us. And then they had to go through their own, you know, failure problem. But you're right. Like, you live in San Francisco. I live in Los Angeles. So we're in, like, the two big cities here on the West Coast that are oftentimes we think of as, like, California and I suppose Florida as well as sort of the testing ground in the U.S. for climate disaster. Not to say that a lot of people aren't facing nor'easters and really extreme winters and, you know, extreme flooding. You know, we saw those terrible floods in Houston somewhat recently and cholera outbreaks and just things that we don't think of as modern concerns. But of course they are. And looking to these ancient cities and seeing how they were able to mitigate disaster in many ways that, like you mentioned, that they could live in a high flood and high drought region successfully. It's hard to envision LA being resilient enough to deal. Like when it rains in LA, the city shuts down. Like people cannot handle it. And so I think about the fact that there are not only places where this was a completely where the people learned to be resilient and made the infrastructure resilient. We see it in Venice, for example, where these buildings actually flood every year and then they just dry them out.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just slowly sinking into the ocean. But you also, it's not just this kind of idea of being more resilient, but the idea that it happened so long ago that we don't need crazy high-tech solutions. Like we can learn some of these simpler or pre-industrial solutions and potentially utilize them in a way that's not financially exclusive. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that we do, especially where I live here near Silicon Valley, we get really hung up on the idea that like we're going to solve this with future technology. And, you know, love future technology, happy for like lots of high-tech solutions. But the fact is that there were people 1,000 years ago and 5,000 years ago who had already come up with some pretty good solutions for dealing with an environment that was going through turbulent changes. Because this is not the first time that the Earth has gone through turbulent changes, not even the first time in human history. This is probably the first time that we caused it or largely caused it. But I think that's neither here nor there. It doesn't really matter who we blame. The fact is we're stuck here. We're dealing with this, the outcome, which is that we have extremely unpredictable and violent weather patterns. And so what we see is that now we're just starting to get urban planners and land planners talking to indigenous communities and saying, okay, look, we need to understand how a 5,000 or 20,000 year tradition in this area kept people healthy and kept them with food that they could eat, despite the fact that they were dealing with tropical weather systems that are very unpredictable. And one of the things that a lot of the archaeologists working at Angkor in Cambodia are interested in is what kinds of urban infrastructure really helped. And it will not surprise you to discover that it's mostly water infrastructure. It's mostly about how do you manage the movement of water through your city using canals, but also how do you store water? How do you help a city have drinking water? But even more importantly, how do you help the city have agricultural water? Because one of the really great tragedies of how we think of cities today is that we forget that a city is always a city plus all of the rural areas around it that produce food and produce other materials that we need in cities. And now, of course, with global capitalism, it's very difficult to say, like, where is the farm that's supplying me with oranges? But that is part of city life. Like, this is, you know, these two things are deeply connected, and the city government, you know, has to be responsible for all of those rural places that are effectively making it possible for the city to exist.
You know, it's funny because I'm trying to like think back to taking courses in like middle school when we would draw pictures of I don't know, Athens versus Sparta. And we, you know, we like learned about ancient cultures, and everything was so caricatured and kind of thin and, you know, sanitized for children's, for, you know, precious white children's eyes, at least in the school where I attended. And when I think about the way that we learned about ancient civilizations and the way that one of the things that we never did is we never made that connection between how things were versus how things are. And that so much of who we are, I mean, we are human, we are Homo sapiens. We have not evolved that much in the last several thousand years. There's been some evolution, but it's little things like, oh, there may be a different kind of muscle in my pinky fingers. You know, it's like, we're this.
We can metabolize milk better.
But like, we're the same freaking people. And so it's pretty interesting to think how when we put ourselves in the shoes of individuals who lived sort of like thousands of years ago, and we think about how they experienced the world, one of the things that was significantly different was modern technology and modern science. Like, it just wasn't really there. There were innovations for sure, but, you know, we look at actually ancient civilizations, super ancient by the discoveries. Like, that's why there's an Iron Age and a Bronze Age, because we know that based on those technological advancements, different things were able to take place. All this is to say, you know, river cities were important. That there were no roads. So you had to like live on a river, right? Because then you could like move shit around because you could put it on a boat and float it up or float it down. But even just living on a river meant living in a flood zone.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's particularly salient when you're thinking about an American city like Cahokia, which it's attached to a civilization that we refer to as the Mississippian civilization, because it literally was built on the superhighway of the Mississippi River. And, you know, they would have been dealing with with weather and floods, but also embracing that kind of ecosystem, because, yeah, they get to drive around. At Angkor, they build canals as roads. And so you see all of these canals connecting Angkor to, for example, quarry sites, so that they can bring all of their great stoneworks into the city, because the city itself is not particularly close to any quarries. And so all of these great monumental towers that you see if you visit the Angkor Wat Park are all like basically stone that was brought in on these human-built roads of water. And then, you know, the other thing is that humans need trade networks, even if they aren't on water. And so you still, even in a civilization like, say, you know, this ancient civilization at Çatalhöyük in Turkey, this 9,000-year-old civilization, we still start to see, you know, products coming in from hundreds of kilometers away, because people are wandering around and they are making contact with people who didn't speak their language and probably had really different traditions. So even these really ancient cities are really cosmopolitan. And it's true, they don't have what we think of as modern science and technology, but they do a lot of exploration. At Çatalhöyük, you know, we call it a Neolithic city because, as you said, you know, there's the Bronze Age, which is the age of bronze. Well, Neolithic is like the new Stone Age. It's the age of stone. And, you know, I want to just trumpet the awesomeness of the Stone Age for a minute, because like stones get a bad rap.
Right. They're just old and dusty.
And it's also like people are like, oh, it's like cavemen and they're just hitting things with rocks. And it's like, dude, you do not know the amazing shit that people could do with rocks. Like, rocks are not just, it's not just like funk, it's a rock. Like, you can carve like an incredibly sharp projectile point that will fucking kill you out of a rock, depending on what kind of rock it is. And people would become incredibly sophisticated at identifying which kinds of rocks you could use for which activities, how you could carve them to be the sharpest or the best scraper. And people eventually at Çatalhöyük invent fired pottery, which, again, basically rock. Like, you're going down, you're gathering clay, you're shaping it into something, and you're firing it. It seems like it would be the simplest thing in the world, but it's actually pretty sophisticated shit. You know, it's like you got your fire, you got your clay, you have to mold it in a certain way. You often want to treat the clay before you fire it. And once you have fired pottery, it creates this revolutionary moment at Çatalhöyük where suddenly you can cook much more easily. It's kind of like the TV dinner revolution of the 1950s. Like, suddenly people who are cooking can just like put a bunch of stuff in a pot, stick it on the fire and leave and go do other stuff. Whereas before that, when you didn't have fired pottery, you couldn't put a pot over the fire. You would have to like actually put things on a spit over the fire, or you'd have to like heat up stones and stick them in a pot with your stew and heat it up that way. So it was like a labor saving device. And was a big fucking deal. Like, I just, ceramics, like, there are, of course, a ton of archaeologists who study nothing but ceramics, because it really is one of the most tremendous breakthroughs in human history. Probably better than bronze in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. It's like fire, or like the wheel.
Sucks. Or like,
yeah, farming. Like, it's a big deal.
Yeah. And it's like, I think we get carried away because like bronze is shiny or whatever. But it's like, you know, ceramics are the thing that actually made the modern world possible, and that made it possible for people to have kind of a more sophisticated division of labor where, you know, you didn't just have to stand over the fire for a really long time. So I am always trying to, you know, pimp the Neolithic and like promote rocks as like cool tools because they don't get enough credit.
You know, I gotta ask, as you were diving into the research for this book and as you were starting to construct your prose and to tell the stories that you wanted to tell, one of the things that kind of comes up for me, you know, attempting to empathize with you in that position is this long conversation that we see in the behavioral sciences between the emic and the etic perspective, right? So like emic research, field research, is usually done from within the group. So like from the viewpoint of the subject, and etic is from outside. So this is like how most historical anthropology was done. Like, I am white. I come to your land. I observe. I write down my findings, mm-hmm. but I don't actually talk to you or ask you about it through your eyes. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering about if you felt any sort of like conflict as you were writing this book, you know, this kind of collection of information that A, you know, your ethic, I'm making an assumption based on everything that I've, you know, read that you've written, your ethic is one that celebrates the sort of etic perspective, yet at the same time, you could only write this from a pseudo-emic way because you are, of course, a modern, white, non-binary individual, but still like a modern person who didn't live in these societies.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm definitely, you know, my deep background is white settler, you know, the people who populated the United States much later in its history. So I was super conscious about that. And to the credit of the archaeologists who I talked to and the experts I talked to, this is something that preoccupies a lot of people who are in archaeology, which is basically a European area of study. I mean, of course, now there's archaeologists all over the world, but archaeology kind of originates in Europe as an idea and as a colonial practice, as you're sort of pointing out that, you know, what it is, you know, white dudes, you know, coming along on ships that are engaged in colonial business, you know, whether that's grabbing people to enslave them or just trading with occupied lands or taking stuff from occupied areas. And then, you know, like I say, scientists would kind of come along and be like, oh, and I've also discovered that there are some great castles here, you know, that once belonged to the people we've been enslaving. So it's a history that contemporary archaeologists are struggling with. And so what I tried to do is be very conscious about that. And there's definitely some very funny bits in the book where I sort of talk about the early efforts of Europeans to try to do archaeological work and how misguided it was and how they kind of left behind all these bad ideas, but also like actual bad chunks of stuff in these archaeological sites. like at Pompeii, you have like all kinds of garbage that people unearthed and just not garbage, but like actual archaeological discoveries that they unearthed and just like threw in a pile. And this is especially the case, of course, at non-Western sites like Cahokia, where when white settlers came upon this extraordinary city, they just turned it into farmland and plowed over it. So one part of it, I think one part of telling these stories is just being aware of the history behind how we tell these stories. And the other part is making sure to talk to people who are from those cultures. And I made a big effort to do that and to also study work written by people who were from the cultures that I was writing about. There's a fantastic, or there was a fantastic Cambodian archaeologist named Bao Savaros, and she's like a huge hero. Unfortunately, she just recently died, and she basically changed the course of what's called Khmerology, which is just the study of ancient Khmer culture, because Western archaeologists had been ignoring all of the inscriptions on temples that were written in Old Khmer, because they were like, oh, who cares about Old Khmer? We only care about Sanskrit.
Which is insane. It's like, it says stuff, but we don't care what it says. Oh my God.
Yeah. But like, they were really, I mean, and there's like levels of colonial weirdness going on here, because it's not like they're saying we're ignoring like the local language for like a European language. They're like, no, we already understand Sanskrit. We know that Sanskrit came from what we consider an elevated culture in, you know, South Asia that had all these, you know, civilizations that we kind of recognize as civilized. And so we're only going to acknowledge that piece of Khmer
right.
culture.
It's almost like colorism that we see within societies now.
It's kind of colorism, and it's also just straight up imperialism right. because, you know, this was an imperial kind of cultural imperialism that had happened where, you know, cultures from South Asia had kind of spread out into Southeast Asia, bringing with it Sanskrit writing and ideas about Hinduism and later Buddhism. But anyway, so once Bao starts thinking about Old Khmer, she's like, you know what? I could make a dictionary and like translate Old Khmer. And she does. And she's working in France at the time. And so she creates the first Old Khmer dictionary, and which now also has an English version. And by doing that, archaeologists are able to translate all of this information about the economy of the Khmer, because they did all of their kind of daily writing, like everyday stuff, like, you know, trading or like, you know, postcards or whatever. That was all written in Old Khmer. And you only use Sanskrit for like fancy shit, like, oh, I'm writing about, you know, gods and kings and stuff like that. But all of the really like the nitty gritty stuff that like actually gets me super excited and that tells you how their society ran, that was all written in Old Khmer. And Bao was working on this in the 1960s and 70s. So it took over 100 years for, you know, people in the West to start paying attention to what local people in Cambodia had to say about their own cultural heritage. And of course, again, she's like a culture hero for doing that. And we're seeing the same thing happen all over the place. Here in the States, there's a lot more indigenous archaeologists and anthropologists than we've ever had before who are able to, you know, help center their experiences instead of having it be like the story of how Whitey discovered the mounds. It's like the story of how the mounds are part of a continuous heritage of, you know, sophisticated civilization that goes back thousands of years in the Americas. So I love that. And I loved that I'm lucky enough that I am writing at a time when there is, you know, more representation than ever before of people from formerly colonized areas, but there's not nearly enough. And I mean, I think we're just at the very, very beginning of what I would consider to be legitimate scholarship and legitimate exploration of these histories, because it really only becomes legitimate in my eyes when it's a dialogue between people who are within the culture and people who are outside the culture.
Yeah. And when those voices are centered, I think that's a good way to put it, because I think the double-edged sword of it all is it's almost like allyship in, let's think about, let's say, male allies in the workplace, that the fundamental truth is that their voices are often more powerful. They might carry more weight with management. And so sadly, the nature of the way that our society is structured right now is that good male allies help elevate women's voices. And we see this in, you know, Black and Indigenous cultures today and Asian American cultures today, that white allies, unfortunately, often elevate voices. And so it's not unfortunate, it's a good thing. But at the same time, we want a future where white allies don't have to do that.
We want a future where white people show their allyship by shutting the fuck up.
Exactly.
And, you know, and exactly. Like, and not in a mean way, like just in a like, let's just have a quiet time. You know, like not, I don't mean it like, shut up, jerk. I mean, just like, just be quiet and listen.
Right. But the problem is that within this culture and the society right now, like within publications and within, like, people aren't listening to the indigenous voices. People aren't. And so there's that power dynamic that still exists where white people have to get out of the way. But a way to get out of the way until they're fully out of the way is to say, I'm getting out of the way, but listen to that person over there.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that's true. And this is part of the the conversation, like in the modern world, this is part of the conversation around changing who's, you know, making the decisions in the media, you know, changing.
And in government.
So it isn't just like a bunch of white. Yeah. And hand in government and hands in, you know, scholarship, for example, you know, people who are handing out the grants to do excavations in, you know, heritage sites. And I think once we start to see every aspect of, you know, archaeology, for example, permeated by diverse people, then you're going to start really not having to ask these questions about, you know, well, who's doing the talking here and like who's being centered and who's doing the elevating? Because at a certain point, it would be lovely to have, you know, an Indigenous person giving a grant to an Indigenous person to excavate at an Indigenous site, and, you know, not have to feel like, you know, Indigenous voices aren't being heard in that process. And, you know, it gets really complicated, right? Because just because you have, say, those three Indigenous things happening at once doesn't mean that they all agree. It doesn't mean that just because you have an Indigenous scholar coming to a site that the people who are associated with that site will be happy about it. They might be like, I don't care. You're not from our nation, or you are from our nation, but we don't like the fact that you're doing this kind of work anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to get to the point where those are the kinds of debates we're having.
For sure.
Actually, instead of it being a debate over like, are you just replicating white settler colonialism? Instead, it's like, well, how does the Cherokee Nation want to handle this? You know, or how do the Osage want to deal with the mound that they're protecting? And I think that is happening, but it's you know, it's not happening overnight. And it's, you know, it's a slow change. But I don't think that we're at a place now where, you know, it's exclusively white people who are elevating Indigenous voices. I think people do want to hear Indigenous stories. And I think, you know, things like, you know, the protests around the Dakota Access Pipeline really reminded a lot of non-Indigenous people that, you know, Indigenous culture has survived. It has an unbroken history and tradition. It's not like, you know, Indigenous people restarted or something right. after colonial incursion. Like they, these nations have survived and are now starting to thrive in ways that are just really impressive. And so I think, like I said, I have hope. I also have a lot of skepticism, too. And I think we are not at a point where we can pat ourselves on the back.
For sure. Yeah, there's still a long way to go. You know, Annalee, I always close my show asking my guests the same two questions. But before we get to that little closing section, I did want to highlight something that I didn't realize before we sat down today. Because, of course, at the beginning when I was sort of still drinking my coffee and trying to put things into words and mentioning, I was like, I don't think of you as a writer, which is like the horrible thing to say. I meant like, I think of you as so much more than that. I don't only think of you as an author because you have worked as an editor of like really important and like basically a curator and editor of super important outlets. But and founder.
I have many
tentacles. Yes, so many tentacles. But what I didn't realize, I mean, I know that you've written nonfiction for a long time and that you've written kind of it within like the sci-tech cultural kind of world. I didn't realize that you've also written science fiction.
I have, yeah. I have two novels, one of which just came out a couple years ago. Actually, both of them have only come out in the last couple of years. The first one was called Autonomous, and that won a Lambda Literary Award, I think because it has gay robot sex
nice.
In it.
Nice. Is it like hot gay robot sex?
I thought it was yeah. hot, and I have heard reports from others that they find it hot as well. It's not like scary robot stuff. It's like tender, sweet Aww. Romance. And the other book is called Future of Another Timeline. That's a time travel novel. And actually a big part of it is set in Irvine, which is down near where you are in LA.
That's an interesting choice.
And yeah, it's where I grew up.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Some,
it wasn't like dart
there's
at
some,
a
like,
map.
Teen angst. No, there's a dose of teen angst because it's about a teenager and then this kind of older version of her and how time travel kind of brings them together. to defeat the forces of moralistic patriarchal dipshits.
I love that. Oh my gosh, that's so badass. I love that so much. How cool to wear so many hats, to dip your toe into so many different kind of creative processes. Are you finding that it is it's been fulfilling for you to be able to express yourself through these different kinds of writing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's really I feel very lucky that I've been able to trick editors into letting me tell the truth about science, but also just make shit up about yeah. science too. And because it really is the case that, and I'm sure you've experienced this too, like after you've been covering science and tech for a long time, you start developing all these opinions about it that are not objective and are not fair necessarily, but that are legitimate. And, you know, you start to want to tell stories about where this stuff might go and how it might change us. And so that's what I get to do in my fiction, is kind of think about all the weird implications of the real life science that I'm covering.
Oh, I love that. And I think that's obviously something that science fiction allows us to do. And the science fiction that speaks to me the most is not like the ultra technical, ultra, you know, I don't want to say nerdy because I am nerdy and I do love nerdy things, but the ultra technical sci-fi. Yeah. And it's much more like the socially aware and conscious sci-fi that grapples with things like ethics and morality and, you know, the human experience, like the psychology behind sci-fi.
Yeah. I like them both, you know, like I think of having scientifically accurate as much as possible science fiction as like a really fun restriction almost.
Yeah.
Like,
so it's more
like,
creative.
How do you build a world? Yeah, it's like, how do you build a world, but like actually try to make it accurate? Although time travel could not ever exist, but let's pretend
right,
it could.
You have to give there's the one conceit and then everything else is built around that.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I'm working on a novel right now that's going to come out next year that deals a lot with far future environmental science.
Oh, cool.
And that has been delightful. Like people planting seeds that grow into buildings and talking animals.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
It's fun.
That's so fun. Oh, I love it so much. Well, Annalee, all right, let's shift gears a little bit. You down to answer these yeah. big picture questions?
I think okay, so. I'm strapped
Yeah, you're
in.
A big picture thinker, so I'm definitely interested in what you have to say. So I want you to think about the future, which you do all the time. In whatever mm-hmm. context is relevant, wherever your head is at, you know, we're in like a weird pandemic brain, you're working on this this new novel, but at the same time, obviously thinking in personal terms and global terms and in cosmic terms, whatever's relevant to you right now. Number one, what is the thing that's uh-huh. been sort of keeping you up at night, the thing you're most concerned about, most maybe even pessimistic, dare I say cynical about? And on the flip side of that, to end on a high note, what are you optimistic about? What are you really kind of like authentically looking forward to and hopeful about?
Okay. They're kind of related, actually. So the thing that literally keeps me up at night, and I'm using literally in the
non-millennial sense,
I actually physically awake. the thing that keeps me awake at night is right now fears about this horrific drought that California is in, and the fact that just a few weeks ago, a group of researchers went out to measure moisture levels in vegetation in California, which is just one way of measuring how likely we are to have wildfires. If the vegetation is nice and lush and plump with water, it's not going to burn as easily. Well, what they found was that vegetation in California, in several hotspots, especially central and northern California, is drier than it's ever been on record.
Shit.
So, The caveat is on record, probably it's been drier.
Right, but these fire seasons have been brutal and it could be worse.
So the hypothesis is that this fire season could be worse than last year's, which was the biggest wildfire that we'd seen in history on the West Coast. And of course, it affected Oregon and Washington and Colorado. The whole West was on fire. Canada was on fire. That freaks me out. I remember several years ago talking to going to the American Geophysical Union meeting and talking to an expert on California drought. And he said, one of the things about droughts is that you can have a couple years of rain in the middle of a drought and it's still a drought. And I remembered like when in California we had a couple years of rain and everybody was like, drought's over. And I was like, no. So anyway, I'm worried about the fires. I'm worried about the drought. But I am hopeful that Biden's infrastructure bill in some form will pass. Maybe we'll get even little pieces of the Green New Deal to go through in some form. I'm not as hopeful about that, but I do think that a robust injection of cash, I don't know if an injection of cash can be robust, but like, let's call it a big injection of cash into infrastructure will really help mitigate some of these dangers. And in saying that, I want to emphasize again that I don't think of cities as separate from rural areas. So when I think about infrastructure, I think about it for areas that are very remote, where people are on farms or people are working, doing whatever they're doing in a rural region, as well as cities. And so I think, you know, if we can take some of that money and use it to figure out how to do things like controlled burns in California, which is what indigenous folks did before white settlers came, and it managed to keep these kinds of mega fires from happening, you know, maybe we're gonna make it through this in style. You know, I'm never worried that humans won't make it because we're just such, you know, we survive. Like, we can eat garbage, you know, we can live anywhere. We will survive. It's just the question is, will it be nice?
Right. Yeah. Will it?
will we survive in a way where we're like still able to like watch cool TV?
And, or will like, it be like WALL-E? Like, I don't want to live in WALL-E.
Yeah, that's the fear, right? Is that, or that it'll be like, you know, some kind of the road scenario, or you know, people returning to the Neolithic, which I was just saying that the Neolithic had a lot of great stuff, but like
that would
you
be
know,
a bit of a culture shock. Still, though, it'd be one thing if it was like several generations from now, but I don't want to wake up in the Neolithic.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you gotta ease into the Neolithic.
Exactly. You know, and maybe the neo-Neolithic will be like, we figured out how to make computers out of rocks. And so it'll all be, I mean, I guess in some sense, computers are like fundamentally made of rocks and minerals, but whatever.
There's your next book. Computers are fundamentally made of rocks. So good.
It is why I often hit my head against them. I think if there's anything I learned from writing this book, it's that good government can save a crumbling infrastructure. And we see it again and again in history. So I'm hoping we're able to pull it out and do that in the States.
Awesome. Well, Annalee, this has been so enlightening. I hope that everybody got kind of their appetite whetted a little bit and it runs out and picks up a copy of Four Lost Cities, A Secret History of the Urban Age. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Yeah, thank you again for having me.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you so much for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.